Our gift to the homeland, another war.
If we are the strong, is this not the signal for war?
Must it always be so? How many comrades have we lost in this way?
Our portion, Commander, is obedience.
Obedience? Duty. Death and more death. Soon even enough for the Praetor's taste. Centurion, I find myself wishing for destruction before we can return.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between the Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, decloaking off the port bow.
Well, that's very timely because we are going to talk this week about the evolution of the Romulans.
Yeah, we've done this before with the Borg, the Klingons, the Cardassians, and Q. I think we hit some of the biggest ones here. There's only one or two left, I think, that we'll definitely want to tackle.
Yeah.
But it's kind of fun looking at how some of the most iconic aliens in Star Trek have really developed over 52 years of history. And the Romulans are an interesting type here.
They might be the most interesting to me in a lot of ways.
Well, okay, so why don't we get into it? We'll spell out for listeners what the plan is here, but we're going to go series by series, starting with the original series. We'll tackle some of the movies as well, but we're going to not talk about, I would say, whether or not we liked a particular episode in which they're featured in.
I don't like any of the episodes they're featured in.
Fair enough, but you know, there's so many good ones, and there's also kind of like clunkers, but I'm more interested in what certain episodes actually revealed about the Romulans as who they are, what they represent. And this is going to be a fun one because I think there's a lot of opportunities for us to maybe even debate at the end, like, is there a future for the Romulans in Star Trek? And so...
Romulans in more Star Trek?
I don't know. Yeah, but why don't we get into it? Because Balance of Terror, such an iconic episode. And this is interesting that the introduction of the Romulans, they're obviously meant as parallels for the Vulcans, not just through physiology, but as kind of a mirror here for the logical sort of philosophy versus more of the, I guess, warlike,
militaristic,
savage. Well, let's get into it a little bit, Cam. Why is this like such a pinnacle episode that established them as a character, or I should say a species that we'd want to come back to?
I mean, Mark Leonard's performance is a big part of it. This episode was based famously on the movie The Enemy Below, which was a submarine film. It's very much a submarine combat in space, but I think the genius
We're talking Romulans here.
Yeah. I think the genius of the episode and the reason the Romulans work is that, you know, because of this format, we spend an insane amount of time with this character played by Mark Leonard, and we really get to care about, you know, this Romulan character. And I think we become more invested in him and just his, the world essentially that he occupies just through spending time with him. I think you could have even swapped in another alien. Like, imagine this character was an Andorian.
Yeah.
I think it would have been an entryway to be fascinated with any species introduced in this episode.
Do you think moving forward that it was a shame that we could not have Mark Leonard continue on as a Romulan commander? And there's maybe... we kind of won out that it ended up being like he did have the Sarek role going forward.
I mean, you know, as we go forward, we'll talk more and more about some of the other Romulan characters, but I do think we need to establish a few more like long-term Romulan characters. I think that would actually help them a lot.
Right.
Because, you know, you can see there's great ones strewn throughout, but none of like I hesitate to call a lot of them iconic. I don't think, you know, that people really know of them outside of the hardcore fandom.
That's true, yeah. This also establishes a lot of the mythology that we'd come to know. Of course, the Earth-Romulan War about 100 years prior to this episode was so devastating that people would hold grudges for what happened to their ancient ancestors decades, or literally a century later, Cam.
I can't relate to that happening in the world at all.
Well, okay. Yeah. Are you a Campbell or a McDonald? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
But do you buy that maybe the Romulans were just so brutal and savage during the Earth-Romulan War that, you know, a lot of people could hold such a grudge?
I can believe it.
Yeah.
You know, what I like about the Romulans is I think they may be the most ambiguous alien race in Star Trek, in that you never quite know what to make of them. They never present themselves right up front, like their motives. Like, you know, you see right from the original series onwards, Klingons, you kind of know what you're getting. You know, when they show up, the crew isn't spending the whole episode trying to figure out what the Klingons are trying to do. Whereas, like, the Romulans, no one's ever sure. There's always this sort of violence attached to them, but you never know if it's going to present itself. And I think that makes them absolutely fascinating, because you can see how they can become allies in some of the episodes we'll talk about later, but also how they can be a great danger.
So maybe that's a perfect way to segue onto the Enterprise incident, in that I almost feel as if we don't know what Kirk's going to do at any given moment, because, of course, it's playing kind of a trick on both the audience, but as well as the Romulans here, because we have the introduction of another Romulan commander, this time a woman who I think it's intriguing that she's trying to integrate Spock, or at least tempt Spock, with kind of a return in, or
A reunification
yeah. with Romulan society, though. Yeah. What do you make of kind of this idea of, like, Romulans, if you look into their history, that there are a lot more hints of that, but they are surprisingly accepting of other species into their fold to a certain degree.
Right, and yeah, we would see that later on down the road.
And we can get into it a little bit later, but I think this is maybe the first kernel of that idea that we have going on in the Enterprise incident, where you have somebody who says, you know what, we have something to gain by getting, and I do believe that the commander is being, you know, truthful when she's saying to Spock, you will become something important here within the Romulan Star Empire if you help us bring this ship back into our territory.
Do you think it's because she recognizes the potential they could use for him in terms of just propaganda? Or, like, just holding, because I feel like Spock is very well known within Starfleet.
I would say yes.
Yeah.
But I also think she genuinely thinks that this is a remarkable man. Like, this is somebody who would actually excel within the Romulan Star Empire. And I think if you look at the very fact that Romulans and the Vulcans are related, in a way that's
with
still
a bit of a Prometheus backstory, potentially. Because they reference it in the episode Return to Tomorrow, where there's those the two surviving alien species that inhabit the bodies of Kirk and the character played by Dan Amaldor. And Spock theorizes that they were the aliens that potentially planted the seeds that formed, that, you know, created the Vulcans, which, you know, would have been the Romulans as well. So, it's like Sergon or something like that. But, you know, I never get the sense that, like, there's often talk about, you know, bringing Spock back into the fold, but you never get, like, a real sense of melancholy about the division between these two races.
Right.
And I'm always kind of surprised by that a bit.
Well, they are so disparate in their philosophies, though. The logical versus the warlike. And look, she's all about conquest. That's not... And I think if she was more familiar with Vulcans, she would have realized that this would not have been a temptation that would have actually worked on any logical Vulcan. Do you think what she was counting on was his human side taking over?
That's an excellent question, because, I mean, she even asks him, do you consider yourself human or Vulcan? And obviously, you know, Romulans being more emotional, there is, I think, a bit of trying to touch a bit of that human side. And you see there's, like, a seduction going on. I think this is, like, a really, really great episode in a lot of ways, just for what it shows us between these two. I think their chemistry is incredible. They may be the most steamy Star Trek episode.
Sure.
Dare I say.
Yeah. It's a pretty low bar, though, Cam.
Sub Rosa, man.
You've got that and decon gel.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a good point. Yeah. But, I mean, do you feel, though, that this character is a little bit betrayed by, essentially, it seems like she kind of falls for Spock. Like, I'm kind of a little bit on the fence about this.
Let's talk about that through the prism of what that means for Romulan society.
Yeah.
Though. Do you think that it's proving that the Romulans, their whole philosophy is not as, I guess, strong as what you'll get from the Vulcans.
Right, like the pure logic will conquer emotion every time.
And I wonder if that's kind of the story that they're telling throughout this, too.
Right.
So I can
that's
buy
that.
That's
an excellent point. It's just that I guess the only reason I kind of nags me a little is because the Romulan commander is such a fantastic character. And that I kind of hate to see her duped like this in a certain sense. Like, I like the idea of her being kind of strong to the end.
And I think what it comes down to is she's counting a lot on their shared ancestry. And I think the very fact of the matter is like, these are species that did not have that much contact with each other. Although, we do get hints that the Romulans had been infiltrating the Vulcans for a very long period. I mean,
right.
It's very obvious they'd been doing that, but with regards to hints about like the length of time that they had been doing that. So I do wonder about how much better, say, Romulan intelligence was about Vulcan versus Vulcan intelligence about Romulus and yes. the rest of their empire.
Yeah, well, it does strike me that the Romulans would have really, really good like spies going on. Far better than the Vulcans.
I think we can get into that a little bit later
on. Yeah, yeah. But, the Vulcans strike me more as like the philosophers, yeah. whereas the Romulans are the ones who are like, you know, the James Bonds of the universe.
Sure.
But there's actually another interesting element of this episode that comes into play. You know, we saw in Balance of Terror that they have invisibility screens, whereas this is the episode that hammers down they have cloaking technology
yes, yes.
that works in motion. And you know the cloaking technology we see in the episode, this big clunky thing that's like a globe with Nomad's head stuck out of it, you know, it's a little goofy looking, but we see this whole episode is about Kirk trying to steal the cloaking technology. And to me, this becomes a really fascinating part of the Romulan species, is this idea of them cloaking. Now the Klingons have it as well, and we see they're using Klingon ships at the start of this episode.
Yeah, I didn't quite grasp that.
There's like a one-off line where he just says, they're using Klingon tech now.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
But from what I understand...
It was to use the models.
But from what I understand, the actual Romulan like bird of prey was yeah. was the one using the cloaking technology.
Yes.
Which is
strange.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
So obviously the Romulans and the Klingons had interactions during this period of time.
Yeah.
So I think if we can jump to the next episode here that I think is worth bringing up, though, mm-hmm. is the Neutral Zone. The Neutral Zone from Star Trek The Next Generation, it had become a bit of an iconic term because it had been featured abundantly in the previous two adventures that featured the Romulans on the original series. Like, when you hear the yeah. Neutral Zone, you know that this is dangerous. This yes. means business here.
That's a great term, too.
The Neutral Zone.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it. But
and just given to an episode that deserves it.
Sure, but with regards to the Romulans in this one, we only got to see them for a very brief scene.
Yeah.
And it is interesting in what's been going on here. The reason why the Enterprise is zipping off to the Neutral Zone is because there's been all these attacks of outposts on their side of the Neutral Zone.
Right.
When they end up encountering the Romulans, they find out, well, the Romulans are investigating the same thing that's happening on their side of the Neutral Zone. And what is noted here is that the Romulans are too arrogant to admit that maybe they want some help.
Right.
This is kind of a through line that I think we get quite a bit.
Romulans, not great communicators.
Well, how do you think this is, is this a big leap from the Romulans that we knew in the original series versus the ones that are briefly featured here in the Neutral Zone, Cam?
Well, we do have a visual reboot, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Okay, and we should mention
yes.
the ship decloaks, and yeah. it's one of my favorite ships of all time
yes.
in Star Trek, which is this new Romulan warbird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, of course, the fashion as well has changed. They're now in these sort of blocky looking clothes that, whereas before it was much more, they were modeled initially on the Romans. The writer who came up with Balance of Terror said it was the Romans. It was always weird to me because, like, he felt very much Romans. Gene Roddenberry was like, no, they're communist China. Whereas DC Fontana argued they were North Korea in the Enterprise incident. And I find it really interesting that you have three visionaries of Star Trek who think this alien race represent a very specific place, and yet they feel so consistent in portrayal. I never get the sense of like they're being altered drastically from episode to episode depending on who's writing it, and I just think that's interesting. And, you know, we go forward into Next Gen and they still feel very consistent to me. You know, we get this visual reboot, we get these different clothing change and everything, which now feels a little more alien, I think, than before.
Mm-hmm.
But they still feel so consistent
yeah.
in terms of behavior and representation on screen.
Okay. I think the thing that's very interesting, though, is if you look at the Enterprise incident, there's a lot of talk of honor,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think it's ever really brought up again in Next
right.
Generation. That's more of a Klingon thing, which
yeah.
is interesting. And that, to me, is kind of a notable development in those, I guess, 7,500 years between the two series.
Yeah. It's interesting because they were supposed to be the big bads of the original series. And then they were too expensive because of the ears.
Right.
And it's almost like the honor thing just got passed on to the Klingons or something.
But not really until
yeah.
like Next Generation, though.
Yeah.
So...
how do you think that happened?
I think, honestly, Ron Moore took the mantle for the Klingons and said, hey, let's develop them into something a little bit more interesting. Because the honor talk wasn't really in the original series movies
like, no.
with regards to the Klingons. I think it was a Next Gen thing that Ron Moore probably went with, and the Romulans, they had to kind of carve out their own identity, which was, and I think you were talking about it earlier with like kind of the mystery behind them.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get even a lot more of that with Next Generation. And right. Why don't we bring up The Enemy? Because this is a very intriguing one in that it starts to a certain degree, demystify as well as humanize the Romulans.
Yeah.
But in a way that I like, in that by the end of this episode, for those who don't remember, Geordi and a Romulan are trapped on an alien planet. By the end of the episode, you know, they figure out if they need to survive, they need to work together. We've seen this story before, but it's not like these guys are patting each other on the backs, giving bro hugs, and promising to be pen pals after that. There's still a lot of enmity towards these two people,
right?
Which is, I think it's a lot more realistic, and it's more interesting story to tell, but you can tell it. I mean, the Romulans, they are kind of frightening. Like, they mean business here.
In many ways, they're the most dangerous. You know, you'd see a lot with the Klingons of the original series, and say, like, a species like the Cardassians or something. Like, they would attack violently, or in a way where it was very much an aggressive hit. Whereas with the Romulans, there's always this looming threat. I mean, you can really see the Cold War analogy a lot, even though the Klingons are always held up as the Russians. You really feel a lot of Cold War storytelling going on with the Romulans. The sense of, like, something could happen at any moment. It's just, it's all about what our heroes say in these moments to stop the potential menace.
And I think it comes through necessity on Next Generation, and that they had established the Klingons war allies during this era.
Definitely.
So who else is going to be the enemy? And it would have to be the
Ferengi, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's what they tried, and they realized, well, this isn't quite working out as enemy number one. Which is why, if we go back to Neutral Zone, it does end with the Romulans declaring, "We are back."
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And now back to the country singer.
But, you know, with regards to what we're getting from Next Generation, you have to make the Romulans scary.
Yes.
Otherwise, and you can't have them kind of like dopes, because otherwise they're automatically not scary. And that happens with a lot of aliens, where, like, you can just fool them all the time. You're like, well, really, do I need to take them, you know, at their word? Like, we can figure it out.
When you look at the show Next Generation, how it's much more, you know, philosophical and in many ways more adult than the original series, the Romulans are a fantastic fit for that series. And you can see how they really don't have to change that much. They can add elements and complications to this species. But you look at, like, the Klingons in the original series versus Next Gen, there's a lot of rewriting and, you know, alterations going on to that species. The Romulans, to me, feel like such a grown-up creation in the first place that they are such an easy transition into Next Generation.
Well, let's talk about something that is, like, a big part of their character as aliens. And if we go into the episode The Defector, I think a lot of it has to do with deception.
Yes.
And this one centers around, of course, Romulan defector to the Federation who's saying, look, there's gearing up for war. Let's go to this planet. You can prove it. It violates the neutral zone.
Right.
And, of course, the Romulans just really wanted to trick the defector and trick the Enterprise.
Poor Jarok.
Yeah. But this is a great one in that, again, I go back to the, more so than the enemy, this humanizes. I think this is the first one to actually truly humanize the Romulans.
Well, I mean, you look at the enemy, too. There is that issue, I think, that makes the Romulans look kind of shady. Well, obviously, you know, you have Geordi and the Romulan bonding on the planet to a certain degree. But then you also have that parallel story of Worf acting as the donor to the injured Romulan. And ultimately, the injured Romulan's like, I don't want your cells. And, you know, it's like really insulting.
And Worf's like, I don't want to give them to you.
Yeah. And so you can see these two parallel, like how one is about a potential Bonnie and the other is like, these two are just too different. Like, we can never work with the Romulans. And I think that works really well when you go into the Defector, because you have these two stories and you can see how with the Romulans, you're never going to get one determined outcome. It could go either way. It just depends on the situation. So when you get the Defector, why would the Federation and Starfleet trust this defector, right? And that's a lot of the suspense of this story is to, can we trust this character? We've seen in the past, you just never know what to expect.
Well, let's talk
And that's where it comes back to the ambiguity. You just never know what you're getting with a Romulan.
Yeah. Let's talk about Jarek as a character in that.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want to focus on individuals, but I think this is very important because we actually see what is possible within the society. And this is somebody who's he can visualize a universe where things aren't, you know, kind of the way that my dictatorial government says it is.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't want to go to war. I want to prevent war. This is what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to risk my own life and maybe even possibly like kind of the quote-unquote honor of my family.
Right.
This is a man who's absolutely tortured by the outcome of this. He ends up committing suicide. And
right.
I wonder, we never really got the suicide kind of cultural strain going on throughout the rest of the series, or I should say not strain, but thread.
Right.
I'm wondering if this is just kind of reflective of Jarek's own decision-making, or, mm-hmm. or do you think there's something here within the culture that would dictate that he would do such a thing?
I mean, I can believe that, like, Tal Shiar agents would commit suicide, yeah. but I don't think your average Romulan military man would just commit suicide. We never got that sense.
Yeah.
Because they talk about, like, they'll do, like, suicide runs in extreme circumstances, but not, you know, like, this sort of thing. But what I really like about Jarek is I think he actually does a really, really great thing for the species as a whole, is that we ground his, like, tragic decisions in, you know, he's abandoning his family, and he's doing it because he's looked at his baby daughter's face and realized he could not continue on with the way Romulan society was going and had to make a change. And I think, you know, you look at the past, these Romulans, they never had necessarily a cause that the human viewer could relate to. And this is like the first yeah. time where they feel, at least in TNG, because I think the Romulan commander in the original series in Enterprise Incident, you can kind of relate to on a certain way. But this one in TNG, you know, you look at the neutral zone, you've got them saying, "We're back." And here's a case where one is saying he looked at his baby daughter's face, and we can relate to that character and essentially, quote unquote, humanize him in our eyes so that we care about the Romulans. And I think this is the first time in TNG we really feel like a human connection towards the Romulans' plight.
It's not just kind of a one-dimensional depiction
right.
of a person.
Yeah. You know? It feels like at this point they're now treating the Romulans the way we appreciate the Klingons being done when you get to TNG.
And I could be mistaken, but I believe that this episode is actually the first depiction we ever see on screen of Romulus. There's that
right,
time where
yeah.
Jarek goes into the holodeck and asks, "Hey, can I see this particular landscape?" And it's actually quite striking. I do give credit for what they're able to do back in the, I think this aired in the 80s or early 90s. And I was like, oh, this is kind of an impressive look
yeah.
for the planet Romulus, which is
right
fascinating there. And well, we got some more looks throughout the years, but why don't we jump over to, we should
also add too, this is the yeah. first time they reference the actual name, the Treaty of Algeron, which establishes the neutral zone, which is definitely a milestone, because we would hear this referenced
oh,
going
yeah.
forward a
it,
lot.
It won't be the last time that we hear about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's talk about one that's a little bit I don't want to use the word problematic, but
sure.
like you wonder what's going on in the heads of certain Romulan agents here with regards to redemption. And this is kind of that two-parter that ended season 4 of Star Trek The Next Generation
mm-hmm.
with Worf being involved with the Klingon Civil War. And then you get to understand that, well, the Romulans are actually the ones playing kind of galactic political makers here.
Right.
You have them lined up. Of course, we're talking about Sela. She's getting involved with the Duras
yeah.
family, and you're
and
like...
Sela is a very important character when we look at the Romulans in TNG.
Yeah. And,
fortunately or unfortunately.
So all this, like, does it surprise you that the Romulans would really want to destabilize the Alpha Quadrant? Like, to me, no.
Yeah. No, I can believe that.
But this is also interesting in that, like, Sela kind of explains her backstory. I mean, we got hints of her in The Mind's Eye, which we're not necessarily touching on The Mind's Eye other than noting the fact that, yes, them plotting that assassination attempt using Geordi, it shows that they are willing to try to destabilize the mm-hmm. political system that is dominant here. But with regards to redemption, we have Sela sharing her backstory and revealing just she's of mixed race.
Yes.
It doesn't seem as if the Romulans are averse to accepting her into society.
Right.
So it is interesting that we do have, I guess, some parallels towards Federation. Like, it seems a lot more open and accepting of other species than we had originally thought it would be.
Yeah.
Like, because you see yeah. these kind of monolithic representations of the Romulans leading up to this. And here's a half-human, half-Romulan that is having, up until this point, a pretty successful career in the Romulan military.
And they kind of talk about the Romulans being really xenophobic and racist, and yet you get these elements of them very much empowering people of mixed race in their society, which I think is really interesting.
Well, I wonder how much of it has to do, and it's a bit of a dirty word here in Canada, but mm-hmm. how much it has to do with assimilation.
Right.
Like, I think the Romulans say, well, if you're willing to assimilate, then we're willing to completely accept you. Whereas
right.
with the Federation, they're like, be your own thing.
Yeah.
It's a mosaic. It's a melting pot. Or not a melting pot, but we are a mosaic. We want
right.
your differences to be our strengths here. So it's kind of a different philosophy, but they are accepting it in their own kind of way.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of diversity in how the various Romulans are portrayed.
And I would say that goes for the Klingons to a certain degree. And
definitely.
Like, a lot of aliens are just by nature kind of a little bit more monolithic. Mm-hmm. Just look, I mean, how many different depictions within a single species can you really have without confusing the audiences?
Very much so.
I get it. Yeah. So Redemption, okay. Romulans willing to go to great lengths to destabilize the Quadrant.
Yes.
We get that. I think another...
What do they get out of that, do you think? What is the appeal of doing that in their eyes?
Romulan dominance. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a constant thread that they are going forward with kind of conquest. And yeah,
very much ties to the Roman ideal of, you know, the balance of terror.
Yeah, you know, well, because I think what the Romans would do, it's not just conquest, but if they could destabilize kind of like these savage tribes in other provinces, and then they can plant their own, like, hand-picked person to lead there, then that's what they would do. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. Like, why would the Romulans not want to have the Duras family in, like, leading the way in the Klingon Empire?
Right.
If the Duras family is so beholden to elements within Romulus. So.
Yeah, it's an excellent question.
Yeah. Why don't we jump over to unification, though? I think this is a very important one.
Yeah, it's like a two-parter that I've never been particularly passionate about.
Yeah.
But it's also one of the most important in TNG when we're talking about the Romulan story.
Yeah, we find out that there's this Romulan underground going on, like a dissident movement that realizes, well, you know what, maybe there's our Vulcan brethren, maybe they had the right idea to a certain
degree. Prometheus aliens, you know, we're supposed to be together.
Well, okay, can we talk a little bit, before we get into unification, and I think this is something that I still need to work out in my brain, so bear with me, Cam.
Okay.
But the exact relationship between the Romulans and the Vulcans, this is how I've always kind of processed it in my head. Let me know what your thought is. But, like, you know... It was established on Enterprise that the Vulcans had nuclear weapons thousands of years ago. So I think the Vulcans were very advanced in technology for thousands of years, but they're more like homebodies. They weren't so interested in exploring the galaxy the way that maybe humans were. So they were thousands and thousands of years ago capable of being spacefaring, but the Romulans were part of kind of like the same Vulcan species and then split off. And over thousands of years, established their own colonies, their own quote-unquote homeworld. And then from there, evolution would kind of take hold in its own kind of way. That's how I've kind of wrapped my head.
No, that's about the same as works in my mind, too.
Okay, then I'm going to have to bring something up when we get to Nemesis.
Okay.
That it confuses the hell out of me. But,
it's not the Remans, is it?
yeah. Okay. But let's get back to unification here.
Yeah.
Because we do have these species, although they've been separated for thousands of years, even though I think it takes a little bit more than... Well, I mean, think about that, how long evolution takes, but it's science fiction.
Right.
Okay. This dissident movement is interesting because there's been kind of hints about unrest within that. We have that with Jarek, of course, from the Defector.
Definitely.
You know, we also have... Of course, our own defector here, one Ensign Stefan de Sève, who, interesting fellow, but again, it goes back to the assimilation thing, where like he's got no pointy ears, but he's willing to get the haircut and wear the uniform, and
it's a bad look.
Oh, it's not cool at all. It's not flattering. But I think this actually bolsters the point about how the Romulans are like, okay, you want to be like us, then go at it, and we'll accept you. And that's also it's good for propaganda purposes. Is if you got a human defector,
of course,
for like the last 20 years, but he ends up very much souring on the whole Romulan way of life because what. Brought him into it is he appreciated kind of their own philosophy. He said that they had like this strict moral compass and that they were always certain of what they were doing. And he kind of realized after 20 years, well, maybe that's not actually true. So he's becoming part of this dissident movement, getting involved with some cowboy diplomacy with one Spock here. What do you make of this dissident movement, Cam?
It's interesting, but I guess I wish I felt more passionate about it, but unfortunately it goes nowhere, so I'm kind of like, I walk away from that episode being like, I don't know, I guess it's interesting in theory.
Let's not think about it in episodes. Let's think about what it means for Romulan society, though. Like, do you A, buy that a dissident movement is afoot, and then B, if it could be successful within Romulan society as we know it? Or do you think Spock's kind of on a fruitless mission here?
It always seemed to me like Spock was kind of on a fruitless mission to a certain degree. Like, it's pretty tough to turn society over. I mean, Spock himself says, you know, this may take a millennia or whatever to even take effect.
Yeah.
That's how kind of how I felt watching the episode. Like, I feel like Spock's steps towards any sort of progress seem very, 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 very minor to a degree where I'm like,
yeah.
I like the idea of what he wants to do, but I don't know that I believe it's going to lead to the widespread change that I think this two-parter wants us to think is possible when it starts off.
It's difficult, especially if they're couching it within like, yeah, it'll take 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Hope your small step is successful at this point.
Right.
Good on you.
Yeah. When we get to our Star Trek show set in like the 35th century, you know, maybe then.
Sure.
Unification will pay off.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about Romulan military strategy, because we got a little bit of insight into this one here.
Yeah.
What exactly is Sela's plan, Cam?
Oh, no. Don't ask me that. Well, they want to embed 2,000 Romulan.
No, I think it's like 3,000, wasn't it?
I think it's 2,000.
2,000. Yeah. Oh, even fewer than I thought.
Yeah, it's 2,000 Romulan troops. She's going to send them into Vulcan in like Vulcan ships as like a peace envoy. And then they're going to be embedded in Vulcan society waiting to spring.
Embedded, Cam.
Embedded.
Yeah.
So
would 2,000 troops be able to occupy one Vulcan city?
Well, they could occupy it, but not in the sense that I think they're intended. They can live there.
Yeah.
But they're not going to have a lot of power.
Yeah. Like, for me, I don't know if it's reflective of Romulan military strategy or Sela's military strategy. But either way, there's major failures here with regards to how this plan makes absolutely no sense. And it all hinges a lot on this speech that they're going to force Spock to make.
Right.
But they're like, oh, no, he's not going to make the speech. Let's make a fake holographic speech.
I'm yes.
Like, so why not just do that in the first place?
Yeah.
And could the Federation not figure out that it's a fake hologram? Look, they gave Riker a bad haircut in that hologram as well, which is pretty hilarious. So,
which fooled me.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, Sela's plan to me is the sort of thing, like, when you state it on a show, I can totally see a lot of viewers, including myself, probably the first time I saw it back in the day, being like, that sounds like a smart plan. But then when you actually break it down and think about it, you're like, wait a second. It's presented in a very intelligent way, but it's not that intelligent.
Not at all.
Is, I guess, the best way to put it. And, like, that's the way I feel about this two-parter is that, like, I want to care more about what is going on, but the Sela story and, like, what she wants to do is so odd that it kind of upsets the whole thing.
Well, is this the reason why we really never see Sela ever again? Does she just become a non-factor within the Romulan military?
Well, I think she's paid off in Star Trek Online or something like that, I've heard. But yeah, no, I think, yeah.
I think the Romulans are like, why are we doing so many of these failed missions with Sela? Time to kind of give her the boot.
Well, and Nimoy said, like, when he shot this two-parter, he was really only in the second part, but he really believed, he's like, there will be a sequel to this. I can totally understand why he would think that, because it seems like this story for Spock it should be very meaningful and something that you might continue in a future season. And especially given the way the Sela story wraps up, you're like, well, there's room for more here. And I think there genuinely was room for more storytelling in this regard, but they didn't seem that interested in doing it.
Well, we get
bits of it, which we'll get to in some episodes coming up, but never to the degree you get in this two-parter.
Right. Well, let's talk about Face of the Enemy, because this is actually the introduction of the Tal Shiar.
Right.
Of course, for those who don't remember, this is one where Troy wakes up on the Romulan ship looking like a Romulan here. And this is really the most time we ever spend within a Romulan ship, just out and about, seeing how a ship functions, how a crew functions, how there's that, I guess, military rivalry between the fleet and the intelligence agency as well, which I find very fascinating, just the dynamics going on there. Even talks about, like, I love that dinner table scene where there just talks about, like, so what did you study exactly and under whom? You know, like, there's so much stuff, like, you're like, okay, I kind of get what's going on. It's almost, and I think it's very intentional, but it's kind of like that Soviet sort of intrigue that you definitely felt during that period.
And you always get the sense, whenever there's a communication between, you know, the captain of our show and a Romulan, there's always a lot of suspicions coming from the Romulans. They're always very suspicious of what Starfleet is up to. And I like that we see in the scene, they're also very suspicious about their own people, you know, occupying various tenets of society.
I think that's very, very important here in that. I wonder how that actually reflects on their own society, where, You brought up the North Korean example earlier. Mm-hmm. If you go to a country like North Korea, there's tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people in gulags there.
Yeah.
It could be through accusations that are made against them that are completely false. A lot of it, it's like, well, your family member did something horrible, so we're going to punish everyone in the family for doing that.
Right.
I wonder how much that culture of fear really impacts people from a psychological basis. And I think that really has to impact the Romulans too in just day-to-day life, if you see how everyone is suspicious about everyone day-to-day.
Do you ever get the sense that life is enjoyable on Romulus?
But you know, okay, so whatever the status quo is for somebody, that's just what life is.
Sure.
Like, I would say, like, they find enjoyment in maybe things that we wouldn't. Would your question be like, do you think life would be fun in the Soviet Union?
Right.
Not by my standards, but I'm sure, yeah, you know, back in the days, they would find their own ways of having fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could buy it to a certain degree. What did you think about the design of the ship? Because the writer of the show complained that it looked like a pizza parlor. He said, like, this is Yeah, he said this is not the design that he was going for here. And I kind of buy it. It looks like a very 90s, very, very 90s sort of look, almost like that Max is from Saved by the Bell sort of color
scheme.
I can't
say it jumped out to me, and like, I never thought pizza parlor. I thought it would it looked very uncomfortable to me. I think it's the sense that everyone has to stand the whole time on the bridge.
I like that, but I'm thinking about kind of the aesthetics in that
right. The
colors look kind of dopey.
Well, you know, they really nailed down over the years what the bridge of a Klingon ship looks like, right? Like, we know what a Klingon ship looks like. And I don't think they've ever really nailed down the visual design of a Romulan bridge.
No, because every time they'd pop up on the view screens, there's always a different background going on. Or every time that, you know, an episode like the next phase where we're in the Romulan ship, it looked completely different than what it looked like in Face of the Enemy. We skip ahead very briefly to Nemesis. That looked completely different than anything we saw in Next Gen. So I absolutely agree with you. And I think it was to their detriment. I mean, they just never really nailed down that look. And I think that's one of the deficits of our exploration of the Romulans here, is because I can totally buy like a consistent look through the original series.
Yeah.
But not so much with Next Gen, which is a little frustrating.
Well, it's funny because, you know, the Romulans, as I said, were going to be the big bads of TOS. And you wonder what a world would be like where they had stayed the big bads. Like, I think the effort you see put into Klingon representations, you know, this consistency we'd see with TNG, et cetera, and, like, the evolution of the design, you'd see that applied to the Romulans. But because the Romulans never quite got that extra push, they are used quite a bit, but they never feel like there's the amount of attention being paid to evolving their style and everything in a way that's consistent.
Yeah. So, look, Cam, you and I, we totally know that there's more episodes that happen in Next Generation featuring the Romulans, but I think the ones that we went through here, these are kind of the ones most important towards revealing their identity, what their culture is about, how their society functions. Why don't we briefly touch on Deep Space Nine, which wasn't huge into the Romulans, and I think that's totally fine. Like, do you think TNG got to the point where maybe they reused the Romulans a little bit too much? Because that was actually a complaint that Michael Piller started to make. He's like, guys, we're using the Romulans too much.
I never felt as strongly about overuse of the Romulans on TNG the way I did, like, the Borg on Voyager.
Okay.
They never felt as much of a crutch to me.
I agree.
And especially once TNG introduced, like, the Cardassians, it just felt like there was a lot more diversity in the aliens they were using. I never got that sense.
And they also eventually figured out how to use the Ferengi in a way that made sense, too.
Yeah.
So I do like how Next Gen eventually kind of expanded its universe and figured out what worked and what didn't work.
And they would just use the Romulans on TNG in interesting ways, or even in an episode, say, like Birthright, which I'm not crazy about. I don't sit through that episode and I'm not, like, annoyed by, oh, here we go, another Romulan story. It's like tackling them from a different angle every time.
Yeah.
It's not like the Borg stories, which begin to feel samey.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So why don't we mosey on over to Deep Space Nine here?
Yeah.
I do want to bring up the search, in that what it does establish is that the Romulans are saying, well, look, there's a huge enemy on the other side of this galaxy. We're willing to give up one of these very precious cloaking devices, which look a lot cooler now, presumably.
Right.
And even embed an engineer on the ship.
Yeah.
So it was weird because Martha Hackett's character, she lasted just that two-parter.
And she was supposed to be potentially a character who would be ongoing.
I think she was supposed to be a recurring character. And did she ever jump out to you?
No.
Yeah, she wasn't. I just don't know if they ever really kind of nailed it. And I think that's.
It's funny because we reviewed this two-parter not too long ago. And when I was doing research for this episode, I was actually surprised to realize she was in the whole thing. Like, I remembered her in the episode, but then I'm like, oh, she's in both parts?
Right, right. I think there's so much potential behind the idea of having a Romulan stationed permanently on Deep Space Nine and serving as an engineer, a cloaking engineer on the Defiant. So I'm legit bummed out that that never came to be. But it is interesting that we have the Romulans willing to actually give up their technology.
Yeah.
With the caveat that, yeah, you can only use this cloaking device while you're in the Gamma Quadrant. Starfleet's like, yeah.
It's a nice cheat, though.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, like, I totally understand why the cloaking tech is a Romulan thing when we go to the 23rd century. Does it seem to you like by the 24th that the Federation would be like, look, we really might need some cloaking technology at this point?
No, because that's the whole point of the Treaty of Elgin.
I know it is, but I feel like there would be some negotiations at some point.
Like break the treaty?
I don't know. I look at it as like the cloaking technology becomes to me something that would be a little more everyday by that point in time.
Okay.
You know
okay.
what I mean? Like 100 years or whatever later down the road, you'd think it would be a little more commonplace.
Sure. But I think the Federation's like, you know, we want to protect this peace that we have between us. We don't need, you know, cloaking devices.
Voyager could have used it.
No, but I think I think Gene Roddenberry even made this point where, like, the Federation doesn't sneak around.
Sure.
You know, they're out in the open. So I would absolutely say, no, the Federation shouldn't have this cloaking technology, despite the fact that Ben Sisko would disagree with me vehemently and use it all the time, especially in the Alpha Quadrant.
If there was ever going to be a captain who was going to get his hands on cloaking technology, it was Benjamin Sisko. Yeah,
of course. We'll jump over very briefly to touch on Inter Arma Enum Silent Legis, which, of course, this dives into actually like Romulan Senate politics. I know your favorite, Cam.
I enjoy this episode.
Okay, okay. Yeah. No, but I love this sort of political intrigue. And this is the most we actually really dive into Romulan politics as they play out. Essentially, two different factions, one the Tal Shiar, one the Senate, debating over who's essentially going to get a Senate committee seat, which I think is interesting.
I would love to be in the pitch session for this episode. And everyone in the room's like, who is going to get the seat?
Yeah. But so it's essentially one Koval versus Kreatak, Senator Kreatak. I think, is it weird that she's probably the most prolific Deep Space Nine Romulan, even though Vrenak probably gets all the memes made out of him In the Pale Moonlight?
Yeah.
And she's played by two different actresses?
I think that's what hurts that character. Yeah. Because you watch this episode and you really feel bad for this character, but I think you would feel a lot worse if she'd been in a couple more episodes and played by the same actress.
I agree with that.
You know, you kind of get the Zial disconnect where you've got like four different Zials, so you don't really emotionally connect to that character at a certain point.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way here.
So and it brings up another question about kind of...
I feel terrible for this character, by the way. You know, we've had a few Romulan characters. This may be the one I feel the worst about.
Do you think Admiral Ross cares?
You know, Admiral Ross is a jerk.
Yeah. But this is... also kind of that picking up that thread of Romulan deception, which essentially we're led to believe that Koval, the head of the Tal Shiar, he's not in favor of the Federation. But we actually find out that's all just a ruse. Because look, it looks who's good. Okay. If you look at McCarthyism, like back in the day, like the people that
Andrew McCarthy.
Yeah. From
Mannequin.
I was thinking Weekend at Bernie's.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. No, but we're thinking about like the staunch anti-communists, you know, way back when, like those could be the ones that would be able to go and rub elbows. So you would never suspect them of being communists if they ever met up with the Soviet or anything like that.
Right.
So that's why they still say, you know, only Nixon could go to China.
Sure.
So who else could do that? So I think it makes sense that you have the head of the Tal Shiar saying, like, actually, I'm not going to say it out loud, but I do favor this alliance with the Federation. I would be better suited for the study committee. Kreatak, though, I know you say you feel bad for her. She wasn't in favor of this Federation alliance, Cam.
I know, but you think about her fate.
Yeah.
Which is like...
It sucks.
Perhaps lifetime imprisonment or execution.
Although, maybe we'll talk about it very quickly in a few moments, but there's hope for her yet. But why don't we skip on over to Star Trek Voyager? I think the reason that we're skipping maybe an iconic episode like In the Pale Moonlight, though, it's like, it's not so much a revelation of what goes on within Romulan society. It's everything that we already
know
before.
Yeah, it's
just
bringing the Romulans into the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but with Star Trek Voyager, there's a very important episode here, and just one of my favorite Romulan episodes, which is Eye of the Needle, in which they find that tiny little wormhole. And in fact, it actually reveals that it actually goes back in time.
Right.
And
yeah, that's 20 years.
Yeah, they're not going to be able to transport the crew through this wormhole like they did with this Romulan captain, he's a captain of a science vessel. He's not a conquistador. He's not there to dominate the galaxy. He totally can relate to these scientists that are lost away from home. He has his own family. This, again, it comes back to humanizing the Romulans.
Well, like the episode The Defector. Like, it works for a very similar reasons. It's one Romulan character that we really get to care about. And, you know, he is, like Romulans, very suspicious, in the beginning.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you see kind of the, what the similarities are between him and, you know, our heroes. And I think very much establishes him as someone we care about. And, you know, the gut punch, of course, of the episodes, they also find out he died before the 20 years was up.
Never delivered those letters.
Well, he might have. They're like, maybe he did.
Okay, so Voyager had a surprisingly strong Romulan episode. Look, they're on the other side of the galaxy. You're not going to spend that much time with the Romulans on Star Trek Voyager. But, okay, let's get to Enterprise, because this is interesting. We had some hints of them with, say, Fight or Flight, that Hoshi Sato episode.
Yeah.
And then in Kirshara, we also, it's revealed that there are Romulan infiltrators on Vulcan trying to, again, destabilize the political order there, which
they're
is interesting.
They're embedded.
Yeah, they really are this time. But it really comes, I guess, into full view for the audience, as well as more of the characters, though, with what's going on with that Babel 1 Enar and United trilogy there, where you have literally that drone ship that is going around pretending to be other ships, leaving signatures in order to make Andorians go against Tellarites against, you know, humans, and so on and so forth. And I think this is really interesting that even though the Romulans ultimately aren't successful here, it makes them look scary still. It's like, look at how far they're willing to go to destabilize kind of these makeshift sort of tenuous alliances that are in place at this point.
It does feel like this might be the most dangerous the Romulans have ever seemed.
Yeah.
You know, they always have obviously a threat that they carry with them through every series, but there's something about this Enterprise portrayal that they feel like really, really dangerous.
Well, is it that they seem... So we get another view of Romulus here, once again, which is interesting, but does it seem as if this Romulan Star Empire as it is, it's a more powerful entity that if they went up against Earth, Earth would get its butt kicked.
It does seem that way.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because Brian Thompson plays the main character, the main Romulan villain in this, and he's terrifying looking.
Correct.
So maybe that's part of it, just physically imposing.
Yeah.
Whereas usually they're a little slighter looking.
Well, the other question that I have about this is I wonder how much the formation of the Federation influenced the expansionism of the Romulan Star Empire. We don't ever exactly know how influential or how expansive the Empire was at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But can't be think if the Empire... Look, we do know there's the Earth-Romulan War, and it eventually kind of leads to the formation of the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romulans see this, and they're like, well, wait a minute. We need to expand as well. We can't have this other alliance that, you know, is going to become more and more powerful be, I guess, the next kind of dominant player here in the scene.
That's an excellent question.
Because also keep in mind, how big is the Klingon Empire at this point?
Well, that's
as well?
The thing. It's I feel like, you know, one thing you can really hit all these shows with is they never really give you a clear idea as to how big these empires are.
Yeah.
Like,
well, all we know is the Federation by the 24th century, it's about 150 planets.
Yes.
Or systems.
Yes.
Or members.
Right.
With the Romulans and the Klingons, I always got the sense that they were about the same size as the Federation, but I actually think the Federation is larger. Like, I think that's, like, a fair guess, because if you have Klingons being kind of the dominant species within the Klingon Empire,
yes,
it's going to be hard for them to control a slice of space that's just as large as the Federation, right?
I would think so, yeah.
If it's just one single species trying to dominate everything.
I think the disconnect for me comes from the fact that when you look at the Federation, you have all these different alien races that make up the Federation, so it seems bigger.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when they hold up a whole bunch of them, whether it's, you know, Vulcans, et cetera, et cetera. it seems bigger.
Well, so is that like one of the big deficiencies with the portrayal of both the Romulans and the Klingons is we never got to see any of the other, you know, species that were part of these empires.
I think that's a big part of it. I think, you know, I mean, I'd like to say they didn't have enough time, but let's be honest, they had a lot of time on all these Star Trek series to do these stories.
I mean, the way I always rationalized it in my brain is that we would generally just see Klingon warships, Romulan warships, and that was their job within these empires is to be the military might, whereas maybe if there's a subjugated species or however you want to define it, maybe they're in charge of the cargo within the Romulan Star Empire.
Right.
Or maybe they're in charge of agriculture on a particular planet. Or, Cam, we know that Star Trek loves mining, so I'm sure there's a lot of mining species, like the Reemans.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point because, you know, you've got the human character defecting to the Romulans on TNG. There's got to be a lot of other species that aligned with the Romulans.
Yeah.
But we never really see that.
Yeah. Which is,
and it's unfortunate.
I agree.
Because I think it would actually add a lot of context to just how powerful the Romulans are in the galaxy. Whereas I think the way they're portrayed on the show a lot of the time is they're always kind of just like lurking in the shadows. But you don't get a sense of huge numbers.
The other issue that kind of irks me, though, is when we do see the Romulans set it in Nemesis.
Right, yeah.
There's only Romulans in it, unlike the Federation Council, which, again, is kind of that mosaic.
Right.
So, it would be... I guess it really establishes the fact that Romulans are just super dominant over the vast array of space that they do control.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something they can correct going forward. But so, Cam,
Discovery, get on it.
Get on it, Discovery. Why don't we talk a little bit about the movies? Because the Nemesis situation, it does confuse me. I alluded to the Reemans earlier.
Yeah.
And then where do the Reemans exactly fit in? Did they leave Vulcan at the same time as the Romulans? And then evolve on an entirely different planet.
In a cave?
Well, essentially in the most dramatic fashion possible. In that they have pointy ears, but they look like orcs from Middle Earth. And it's just like...
Or Nosferatu, yeah.
I just don't understand how we get the Reemans. Like, where like that comes in the evolutionary timetable of everything.
Do you think that John Logan thought about that when he was writing that script?
It's funny because there's like enough references that I'm like, okay, John Logan is a fan of like Next Generation. You can tell. But there's other stuff where it's just so weird they'd put the Reemans in the first place without really thinking about how they actually got to Remus and everything. But they are very much a subjugated species. Like they're like essentially cannon fodder during the Dominion War.
Yes.
It's kind of a horrible way to live that they're subjugated to being in mines. It's like, oh god.
Yeah, I mean, they could have just said they were some species that was assimilated into the empire that they used as like labor or something. Like there would have been ways around it that wouldn't raise all these questions,
except for the pointy ears, man.
Yeah.
So I don't, this one was like there's so many questions that came out of the appearance of the Reemans that it just confuses me more than
now,
anything
you
else.
Were on the boards in these days, right? In 2002?
Yeah.
I'm curious, what was the response to the Reemans like at the time?
Nobody really liked Nemesis, though.
Right.
It wasn't very popular, so I remember people were pretty meh. I think, but this movie came out right around the time that Lord of the Rings was coming out.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of orc comparisons.
Sure.
So I was like, okay, people just thought they kind of looked derivative.
Right.
But and also, the portrayal of the Viceroy, is as much as I like Ron Perlman, it wasn't a very interesting antagonist at all.
Does he even have a name?
No.
Yeah, he's just the Viceroy.
Viceroy. Yeah. So it's like, okay.
Yeah, I wish I cared more about the actual Romulan storytelling in Nemesis, but I feel like a lot of it is surface level, and I think that's, you know, largely because this movie is made for a mass audience, not for a audience tuning into Star Trek every week on TV. And so they weren't going to delve too deeply into it.
But I will tell you that there's a very, very big implication for the Romulans within this, and that the entire Senate is assassinated.
Yes, like, that's true, so in the opening, yeah.
How does that actually affect the political order of the Romulan Empire? In that, it's always been a military-driven society. I'm sure those politicians could be easily replaced by some sort of, you know, military proxies, but Look, Nemesis was pretty much like kind of the last dedicated adventure in the 24th century. So I'm just wondering if we go back to the 24th century, in those intervening years between Nemesis and Star Trek 2009, what was really going on within the Romulan Empire as a whole, and like how influential was this? If you had like all, just think about all the knowledge within the Senate that was lost right there. You know,
right.
We had Koval and Kreetak fighting over Senate seats. So I wonder if Kreetak was able to commute her sentence or make an escape somehow. Maybe. So that's why I say there's maybe hope for her.
Hopefully, fingers crossed. Yeah. I'll sleep better at night.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I always find when we look at the history of Star Trek canon, just because of the fact, you know, the shows end at a certain point, it gets spotty when you get to these later movie eras where you kind of have these time gaps and you're like, what was going on during these time periods?
Yeah,
you know, it's like you get the bigger picture as to what's going on with your favorite characters or whatever. But there is the question, yeah, like what happened with the Romulans after all this? This seems like a bit of a headache.
Well, Cam, I think the bigger issue, though, is let's get to Star Trek 2009.
Yeah.
This is the end of Romulus. Romulus yes. has been destroyed. This is not the Kelvinverse.
They never recovered from Shinzon.
No, exactly. I mean, like, this isn't the Kelvinverse. So this is the Prime Universe.
Yeah.
Like, Romulus, as we know it, is completely wiped out. I'm sure the vast majority of Romulans, the ones that were on the planet, billions of people, gone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this has huge, huge implications for what it means for the future of the entire Alpha and Beta quadrants, where, like, just the entire political order of things. You've got a very weakened Klingon Empire following the Dominion War.
Yep.
You've, like, the Cardassian Union's influence has been completely wiped away. I think that it's obvious that this union is probably dissolved by this point.
Yeah.
The Romulan Senate has been assassinated, and then a few years later, all of Romulus has been destroyed.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of this new, I guess, Federation dominance. I see the Federation just expanding so much because of all these destabilizing factors. The Romulans wanted to be the ones that were destabilizing everything,
right.
But like, look what happens. Like, they're the ones that end up most destabilized. Like, even Cardassia made it out of the Cardassia or the Dominion War.
Right.
Romulus, not so much.
Yeah, well, maybe that's, you know, maybe it's appropriate that there was that Bryan Singer series that was going to happen, Star Trek Federation, that he was trying to develop, in which the Ferengi took over the galaxy, basically.
I can buy it at that point.
Because the Romulans certainly weren't at this point.
Do you think maybe the Riemans step in? Is that it?
Riemann on the bridge.
Yeah, well, I just wonder, okay, well, let me pose this to you. Maybe the remaining Romulans are like, wow, like, we are lucky to be on this colony or this ship at the time that our home planet was destroyed. We need to integrate way more of our, you know, members into our fleets. We need to make them more part of our own society. And I wonder if this actually spells like just this drastic shift, not in like a downfall of the Romulan Star Empire, but a reimagining of what it actually means to be a member. I picture a Senate, maybe based on Remus, which features like a vast array of different species because of what happened here.
Do you think ultimately this did good, not, you know, obviously did bad for a lot of Romulans, but do you think it does good for the progression of their society in some ways?
Yes. In you use the word progress here,
right?
I think it is a horrible tragedy, but it's actually leading them towards a more progressive society, at least the way that we would define it here in the West. And it probably makes it a little bit more like the Federation. So, but do you buy more into that little theory that I've posed, or more into the idea that maybe the Federation absorbs more of, say, the remnants of the Romulan Star Empire or the Cardassian Union?
I don't see
the Cardassian Union existing.
No, I don't look at the Cardassians as any sort of power player going forward.
Like, I think it just comes, I think the Cardassian Union is essentially that one planet, and then all of the members of that, they all declare their independence following the war, or else they get absorbed in the Klingon Empire, the Romulan Empire, or the Federation.
I never felt like the Cardassians were set up on the show as like a species whose power reign was going to last, or who are going to continue to be these major players in the galaxy. Like, it did feel like that was their attempt at grabbing power, and it didn't work, and, you know,
well,
they suffered for it.
They end up very much in the same positions that the Bajorans did when we first met the Bajorans, which is a very interesting parallel.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, I do wonder, though, I mean, look, I like that they were willing to do crazy things in 2009 by destroying Romulus. Like, you know, a lot of franchises would not do this sort of thing to such a prominent element of its friend of its world building. But I mean, I do wonder, like, in a Star Trek you know, film or series going forward from in this time period, does that rob us of the interesting Romulan storylines that we've grown accustomed to?
Yes.
Yeah.
Although I think it actually opens the door to some even more interesting ones, and where you have
Unification 2, maybe.
Or 3?
Well, I guess so.
But no, I think it's interesting that, like, it opens the door to what is a society, and it also parallels the journey that the Vulcans are going on in the Kelvin universe. And
right.
You know, but, like, what does a vast empire do when, like, you know, when Rome essentially burns?
Right.
And if we use, like, Rome as the parallel, it's not great
for
the future of the Romulan Empire.
No, it's not at all.
So...
But it kind of takes away a lot of the heft of such a fascinating screen presence. And that, you know, you like the idea of the Romulans always kind of being there and, you know, just waiting across the neutral zone, essentially. And you lose that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I feel about it, because we haven't explored a Star Trek series in this time period post the 2009 film. Like, I am very curious what that is like. What is that world like watching, you know, the adventures of a weekly series where the Romulans aren't looming out there in the numbers they once were?
Let's maybe talk about what the future may hold as viewers, not necessarily Romulan society.
I have one question I want to ask just as we're wrapping up the films. You know, they talked about having the Romulans as the villains of Star Trek III. They end up going with Klingons. We didn't get the Romulans until Nemesis in 2009.
They're actually supposed to be the antagonists for Insurrection as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Do you think that that was a good decision to keep tabling the Romulans from appearing in the films?
No, I don't think it was.
Yeah.
I think the Romulans have this interesting nuance to them that maybe you didn't always get with the other antagonists, such as the Klingons that were introduced. So I don't think it was a good idea. So I just wonder what the disconnect is between me and the decision makers at the time.
Yeah,
what about you, Cam?
I could never really make sense of it. At the time, watching the movies as a non-fan, it didn't jump out to me. I was just like, yeah, more Klingons. Okay, cool, whatever. But when you actually watch the series and you see how prominent the Romulans are throughout and how compelling they are, and it just seems like you could have made a really strong original series film around them, especially, I mean, Balance of Terror was held up in very high regard. And it just seems to me like, why wouldn't you try to tap into that at some point?
Studio politics, man.
Yeah,
it's just something
just really, really weird to me. You know, they throw that Romulan into Star Trek V on Nimbus, who is the most un-Romulan Romulan I can ever imagine.
Yeah,
and I want to reference her on the show just because she is such a smiley character.
But okay. You bring that up, though, but let's touch on Nero. Does he seem like the Romulans as we've come to know them?
I've always joked that I like him because he's like an idiot, and it's what happens when an idiot gets a lot of power.
Okay.
He's very...
But does he seem like an idiotic Romulan? Like, there's nothing about him
no.
to me that seems like a Romulan, though.
No.
I mean, it's obvious why they're introduced as the antagonists is because of that parallel between the destruction of Romulus and the destruction of Vulcan.
He kind of has that fiery kind of passion you hear spoken about with Romulans.
The way the Romulans are always depicted, though, is like they always keep their calm and they're cool.
Yeah.
And this is not something Nero ever did. To me, he is, I would say, one of the least Romulans we've ever encountered.
To be fair to Nero, though, I mean, throughout the course of all these series, we've always seen military members of the Romulan Empire. You know, that's who we've always been exposed to. Here we're seeing a miner, you know, basically like a blue-collar miner.
Yeah.
So it actually affords us a glimpse at Romulan society we hadn't gotten before. You
yeah.
know, we've always talked on the podcast about how with the Klingons, it's always these warrior Klingons. Like, what about the artists?
Although you are forgetting about the Romulans who dish out soup in Unification, Cam.
Oh, that's true.
Do you remember the soup scene?
How could I ever forget that?
Okay.
Yeah, I do remember that, actually. But Nero is, being, you know, very kind, he's a three-dimensional Romulan character, major antagonist in a film who does not represent the same type of Romulan we've seen in how many hours of television, which is interesting. Like, it gives us something different, I guess.
And I do wonder if that's going to play out if and when the Romulans make an appearance on Discovery, though. If you asked me, do I want to see more Klingons before Discovery started, I'd have said, no, I've seen enough Klingons. But if you asked me, would I be interested in seeing Romulans, I'd be like, sure. I think there's a lot more to mine from that. But there's a lot of obstacles. Of course, because the humans and the Romulans had never actually seen each other.
Right.
Which doesn't mean the audience can't see the Romulans.
Sure.
I think that's, and that's what they did on Enterprise.
Yeah, the audience, they did it very well.
Yeah, the audience.
I remember kind of
blanching. Sorry, on Enterprise, the audience always saw the Romulans, but yeah, the characters did not.
And I remember kind of blanching when I got to that episode of Enterprise and they brought in the Romulans. I'm like, wait a second, you can't do that. And then it worked so well.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, the other thing they can do is just, if there are one-on-one encounters, the Romulans are known for wearing helmets.
Sure.
So, yeah, put a helmet on them. But do you think they're worth bringing back in Discovery during this era after what's been established on TOS with such... The reason why those two TOS episodes stand out is because of the dynamics going on between the captain and the first officer and the respective Romulan officers.
Right.
We're not going to get that here.
No, we are not. So then I question, what can we do with them? Because I think I Enterprise found the best way around it. And
do you think it's just going to be another pass at what they did on Enterprise with, like, Romulans infiltrating Vulcan?
That's all I could really think of.
That's my best guess.
It's something where the Romulans are spoken of and referenced, and they have to stop something, but we're never going to get any sort of encounter with the Romulans.
So if they do come on Discovery, what about the look of the Romulans? Because they're...
Tattoos on the face, just like 2009, obviously.
I hope so. But if you look at the Romulans on the original series, they're identical to the Vulcans. Then they do get the updated look on Star Trek The Next Generation and going forward after that. Would you want them to just look identical to, say, the Vulcans here in this time period? Would you want them to have, I guess, some of those cranial ridges that popped up on TNG, but like more of an updated look? What would you hope for the look of the Romulans, Cam?
Well, I'm just curious, where do you stand on the cranial ridges? Like, do you, when you, because people go crazy, obviously, about the Klingons and the ridges, right, on the original series versus going forward. When you look at the ridges on them in TNG, on the Romulans, do you just go, I'm sure they were on them in the original series? Like, it's more of like, yeah, they had it. They just didn't have the makeup at the time.
No, in my head, I'm like, well, it's been 100 years.
Sure.
It's science fiction. There's maybe some evolutionary reason behind it. I don't know.
Okay. Like, I was always willing to give them more of a pass for some reason. Maybe it's because it's less drastic than the Klingons.
Sure.
I would just be like, ah, they didn't have the makeup at the time. They had them.
But the issue then is why the Vulcans look in the TNG era look without the ridges? Like, they're supposed to be identical looking species, right?
I just wonder if it was to be a little more different looking. If they just want a little more of a visual difference between the two, because it would get confusing if you stood two of them next to each other.
I think so. That's what it is. So
because you got a view screen on the original series where they're actually separated versus TNG, you've got them mingling together in theory.
Yeah. So then what would you like from Discovery when it comes to the depiction of them?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting with Discovery in particular, because you look at what they did with the Klingons, where they went so drastic.
Yeah.
But then we also saw the Andorians look pretty similar. The Orions look fairly similar. And so I'm not sure what to expect if they're going to bring Romulans. Like, are they going to keep...
What would you like to see?
I mean, I think they should stick to a similar template as TNG did. Where, you know, I don't want them to look like clones of Sarek, essentially. You know, the same sort of Vulcan look we're getting on Discovery. I would like to see a little bit of a difference. Whether it's an exact replica of the TNG ridges, that's not necessary. But I think I would like to see some sort of slight alteration in the face.
I'm okay with the Sarek clones.
Are you?
I mean, that's how they looked back in the original series era. So even though, the Andorians during the TOS do not look exactly like the Andorians now.
Or the Tellarites.
Or the Tellarites, yeah. So I guess I have my preference, but I do expect a bit of an update. It's going to be probably cranial ridges that look a little bit cooler than the ones that we got 25 years ago.
Maybe a slightly different pallor to the skin.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Something like that.
I'm down for it. And I do hope, though, I do hope the style is a little more TOS or Enterprise in terms of the clothing.
Oh, yeah.
I actually far prefer the clothing in those eras to the TNG forward era.
I think even the writers in TNG weren't fans of the wardrobe. Yeah, they thought that
it's such a distinctive choice, too.
But they thought the shoulder pads just looked really silly. And so when you get to Deep Space Nine, they get rid of the shoulder pads. I think that Martha Hackett's character from The Search was the last one in DS9 with shoulder pads.
Right.
I could be mistaken because, of course, there was The Die is Cast two-parter. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And they may have had shoulder pads, but I don't think they did anymore. I think they were just kind of sick of shoulder padded Romulans. And I don't want to see Romulans with shoulder pads. I love the TOS Romulan uniforms. Those are among my favorite on TOS. And TOS had so many... I just find the TOS costuming so much more interesting than what we saw in the next-gen Berman era.
Right. Next-gen sometimes hits on some home runs, but a lot of it does feel kind of... It's either bland or just kind of generic, or it's like the Romulans, or it's like the Romulans where it's just weird. It's like weird in not a good way, in a way that doesn't age well.
Yeah,
but I mean, can you imagine if they put Tom Hardy in that uniform?
Oh, that'd be badass. Yeah. So, Cam, before we wrap up today's episode, though, we do want to touch on last week, which we were both devastated with the technical issues.
I don't know if people will ever understand how, like, just driven nuts we were by that.
Yeah, but, you know, for those who maybe didn't tune in, we did get the first half of the episode out there. No sound quality issues there. It's just the last half of the episode, perhaps the most important half of the episode, in which we're drafting our dream Star Trek crew. But we did get a lot of great response from people. So have a moment to just read a little bit of the responses here. Here on Facebook, one Tiberius Scott, he's picking his dream crew. I want to share this with all of our listeners. He says, as captain, he'd go with Picard. Mm-hmm. First officer, Kira. Then science officer would be Seven, security Tuvok, engineering would be Prime Scotty. Then you'd have Crusher at the helm, you'd have Crusher as a doctor, and you'd have Vic Fontaine as your morale officer.
Well, I mean, a lot of those match up with my picks. So, I mean, I'm mostly in favor of this. Although, Crusher at the helm, Wesley Crusher at the helm, would that be my choice out of all the helmsmen in the Star Trek universe?
I think I had the best helmsman pick when I went with Jadzia Dax, where you got a great pilot who's also a badass science officer. That's such a twofer. I think that was like one of the biggest steals I had of the game, because I also got to pick another science officer on top of that. So I did okay for myself.
Yeah, I don't know that Wesley Crusher wows me the way that like Sulu does. Or I mean, I went with Tom Paris.
Yeah,
mostly because Sulu and Jadzia Dax are off the table.
Fair enough.
But I mean, I guess I don't know. Is there anything that jumps out to you with this list that maybe stands out to you as odd, or that you would not necessarily be a big fan of?
I think the one thing that maybe I blanch at, and
it's pretty strong overall. Yeah. I don't have a lot of. I'm just trying to find some points that I wouldn't have done.
Crusher probably would not be my number one pick for helm. I agree with that. Yeah. So, Cam, we've got here on Twitter, we have one Javier Tarise. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, so I apologize. But he said his pick for captain would be Picard. First officer would be T'Pol. Science would be Jadzia Dax. Ops would be Data. Malcolm Reed would be at security. At the helm, we'd have Kayla Detmer from Discovery. Engineering would be O'Brien. Doctor would be Crusher. The counselor would be Deanna Troi, and the morale officer would be Garrick, which I could picture myself as an audience member finding him very amusing. I wonder how amusing the people that spend time with him would find him.
How pleased would Garrick be with this title? I feel like he would loathe himself.
Yes.
For this. Like, there's that episode where he's like freaking out about being a tailor and he's like ripping up his clothes. I feel like he would be throwing parties and then like popping all the balloons in anger.
I could see that.
I gotta say though, this is a pretty great list. I mean, I'm really pushed the merit of Malcolm Reed, and I'm very happy to see him on the list as well.
Yeah, yeah. You know, look, I think we benefit greatly from having such a wide array of awesome characters to choose from.
Definitely.
So yeah, this is a fun episode. We just wish the technical issues did not plague this.
But I think the episode is still very entertaining, we
definitely
should say.
Give it a listen, just at least for the first 45 minutes. It's still like a really fun one. We've got a great guest with us as well. So that is the last week's episode, guys.
Definitely.
Yeah, so Cam, before we wrap up, is there anything I can get you to plug?
Yeah, you can also check out the podcast I do with Tony G, who's been a guest on this podcast several times. He did our Future's End episode. He does all our time travel films and two-parters. I don't know how that happened, but it's become kind of a trend. Yeah, we do every 2 weeks we review a Arnold Schwarzenegger film and take it apart.
What's the name of the show, Cam?
It's called Arniegeddon. Yes, it's a very clever title. I'm not going to say who thought that one up, but yeah, this week we've got, I think, the review of Predator 2 out. Every 10 episodes we're doing a film that's only tangentially related to Arnold, like a franchise he spawned or something like that, or a remake of a film he was in. But we'll have reviews coming up of Running Man and Killing Gunther.
Nice. Yeah. And then for those who don't know, Cam and I, we will be at Star Trek Las Vegas this coming August. We're going to be doing a panel. It's going to be a lot of fun talking about the evolution of storytelling in Star Trek and how we've become more and more serialized over the last 52 years. But there's been hints of serialization throughout all of Star Trek's run. So we're going to have a fun time talking about just the way that storytelling has developed so dramatically over Star Trek's history and how I think Discovery is playing into that, and we're going to talk about strengths, weaknesses, what works. It's going to be a great one. Come say hi to us while we're in Vegas as well. We love just talking to listeners there, which we've been able to do in the past. And yeah, Cam, we should not make fools out of ourselves, that'll be good.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, I'm just going to say this. Star Trek Extreme Makeover Edition.
Wow. Are we just going to say that?
No. Okay. but look, I think, listeners, this sounds out there. It sounds wacky. It sounds silly. But Cam and I, we're going to have an intriguing look at the way that characters' own looks have changed and how that actually impacts the way that we view these characters. And I know you're thinking, like, well, what do you mean by that? Small spoiler here, but look at how Seven of Nine transformed from literally a Borg drone into the Seven of Nine as we know her. What does that represent for the character? And there's so many other characters where we have these different ideas of what they look like in our brains, depending on when we maybe jumped into the series and what that maybe signals for maybe a turn in storytelling. So it sounds a little bit out there. It's going to be a fun one, and it's actually going to be a little bit deeper than I think people think just by the title of Star Trek Extreme Makeover Edition.
Well, it can't get any shallower.
No, we are two very shallow dudes.
That's
so.
Right.
There you go. But and I'll also say this. This is not judging people on their looks. It's not like a hot or not sort of thing.
No.
It's about what kind of these drastic changes to the way that characters are depicted actually signals for those characters and their development. So it's going to be fun.
They're all hot.
They're all hot, yes.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Valdor, Vrax, and Vrenak Smith.
You can find me at Reporton, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in Nero had a bit of a point, didn't he?
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.